This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. The previous economic update with Richard Wolf will be back on the air at its regular time at 6:30 p.m. It is almost one minute past 7 p.m. Stay tuned for Off the Hook coming up.
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up and try again. If you need help, stay on the line and a hacker will assist you shortly.
Everybody, the program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening. Joined tonight by Kyle.
Hi, Emmanuel. How are you?
I just spilled coffee on my laptop, but other than that, I'm fine. It was a much smoother beginning than last week, except for that. It was going so well.
Don't worry about it. That makes it run faster.
Well, I don't know. I guess we'll test that theory, but fortunately I had a napkin and I was ready. Who else we have over in Skype land? Let's go over there. I see Rob.
Good evening. I don't have any coffee.
I see Gila.
Hello.
I see Alex.
Good evening.
What kid show am I referencing? Remember, they used
romper
to look in.
Room.
Was that Romper Room? I used to watch that as a kid. Okay, so that makes sense. That makes sense.
She never saw me.
Huh? I've been having
I
all
never
these.
Never once heard her say, "I see Gila."
Yeah, I don't remember. I could fool myself and say, "Yeah, she said she saw me once." But how did you get to be seen? You had to write in or something, right?
You had to either write in or have a generic name that she would have a chance of saying. So I was pretty okay.
Okay.
Every time she saw Rob or Robbie or Bobby or Robert or whoever, like, I took it.
I've been having all these childhood memories of things like that. But the other day, I just remembered the breakfast cereal Wheatina. Did anybody ever have Wheatina? See, nobody remembers this. Any listeners out there that remember this cereal, it was the counterpart to oatmeal. In fact, it might have even predated it. Spelled Wheatina. I think it was spelled that way. I don't really know. That's my trip down memory lane, whether it exists or not. I'm still wiping the coffee off of me.
Do you need a mop or something?
No, I'm all right. I've got these little notepads that I can use. They're pretty absorbent. So how are you guys doing?
We're okay. We've been watching television for most of the afternoon and evening.
Whoa. By television, do you mean something educational, like General Hospital, or do you mean something dark and sinister, like C-SPAN?
The latter.
Actually, it's really good that you are watching the trial of Donald J. Trump, the second trial. Because it is as educational as you can get on television, and it's something that I think everybody should see. They should be showing this in classrooms, and early too, like second, third grade, I think.
It's amazing because they're showing so much footage that we've never seen, so much footage that had never been shared, and footage that we cannot really discuss because it has words that would get us fined in it. And I'm still stunned by hearing that on, like, being played in the Senate.
Well, that,
I shouldn't be, but I am.
That is the incredible thing. And, yes, you speak exactly to the things I've been thinking about as well. But those films, very well produced. Who knew that Democrats could piece together documentary footage so well? But they did a good job. Very riveting. But, yes, uncensored. The thing is, every broadcast network, except, of course, Fox, had this on live TV yesterday and today, and there was no censorship whatsoever. They were using all kinds of foul language. And, yeah, I mean, I don't mean to dwell upon this because I think it's incredibly petty to say, oh, what about the FCC, and aren't they in danger of being fined? But we have to live like that all the time, being at a radio station. We have to be very careful about what we say. So I think we need some clarification as to when this sort of thing is permitted and when it is not permitted. And somebody I know raised a very good point that, well, you know, technically these are the FCC's bosses doing this and kind of, you know, saying we're gonna have this aired on broadcast television and maybe even radio. And that's just the way it is. I don't know. Alex, what's your take on that?
I mean, I don't know. I think I think there's wisdom in getting this out to everybody, right? But I don't know if we need to clutter the airwaves with it, you know, 100% of the time, you know, that it's on. I feel like, you know, people need to make a choice, an informed decision. There's plenty of places to see it. You know, I have to say, you know, I followed it very, very closely yesterday, but today I haven't been, you know, as engaged with the impeachment proceedings, primarily because I've just been so busy.
Okay.
So I think it depends.
Well, I mean, yeah, you can see it anytime you want. Obviously, it's all being recorded. But as far as the importance of having it there, I think, you know, if the Democrats don't succeed in getting a conviction, what they have succeeded in doing is getting this documentary evidence out to the general public. And, yeah, like you say, you can always find it someplace. But I think it should be more than that. I think it should be something that people have thrust in their faces so they can see exactly what happened on January 6th, and they can't just ignore it or have to hunt it down. It's there. It's there on Channel 2. It's there on Channel 4. You know, and wow, maybe they had no idea that this is what was actually happening. I was surprised. Like you said, you know, this was really compelling evidence and video footage that so many of us had not seen before. Rob.
Well, of course, the FCC issue is close to all of our hearts here at WBAI, us being the station that had the landmark case that dictated all that for the rest of eternity. But another thing about this footage is how uncensored it is, not only because it gets sweary, but because it gets violent. Mm-hmm. There are the violent insurrectionists. There was footage of a death, the shooting death that happened, and that's all part of the congressional record now, and that is something that every single voting human being should see. The people who, it appears, don't have to see it are the Republican Congress members who apparently are just, like, looking down at papers or something while these videos are playing.
Yeah, I heard Rand Paul was looking at his iPad or something, which is shockingly appalling as far as I'm concerned, to not be, not at least pay the respect to look at what was happening. It affected all these people, too. They were all in the building at that time. It's just incredible to me, and I can't imagine the emotion that some people there might be feeling at having to relive all of this, you know, to see it all playing out and know that, you know, you were this close, you were there when it was happening. Yes, Gita.
One thing that I've been seeing today, as I've been watching this incredible footage, and I don't mean that in a good way, but it is, it's amazing to see all of this and how much of it was saved by the amazing Twitter user Donk Enby, who scraped all of this stuff from Parler before it went down. So it's here, and it's in the congressional record.
Yeah.
Because of the work that she did. So we just, thank you again, but
it's amazing what one person can do to help in situations like this. And there are lots of one people out there that can, you know, one person's out there that can do this, that can do different things, add their perspective, add their expertise. We're seeing it every day. So don't think that you don't count. Don't think that, that you know, your opinions don't matter or that your skill set doesn't matter. It all adds up. Just like donating to WBAI, which, by the way, I'm just going to pivot into this quickly. Please, 516-620-3602. Every person who calls that phone number and contributes whatever they can afford is one piece of the amazing, I guess, puzzle that WBAI is, or just in structure that we are. We've been around since 1960, and it's all through listeners like you, all through individual people. It's amazing. 516-620-3602, or go to givetowbai.org. Alex, did you want to say something? I thought you had your hand up. I think you're muted.
Yeah, mute issue. So over here, I think you were acting like an auctioneer. I think, but you know, I think to Gila's point here, this I think it is incredibly important to see this in the congressional record and to bounce off what Rob had said. What I was really shocked about was just you know the sounds. You know, when you hear that, even if you had your eyes closed, you can imagine what was happening there. It was terrible. It was really woven together, I think, very, very effectively. It made a great case for creating a nexus between the president's words and the actions that flowed very proximately thereafter. And this is the case that they're trying to make. When you saw the lawyers for the president take up their case, you know, it was a completely different story. You know, I don't want to cast aspersions on other members of the bar, but those particular types of those presentations were rather disjointed, rambling, and it seemed to me like the Democrats, and I say this lovingly, the Democrats for once really had their act together.
Yes.
They were coordinated. They collaborated together. They put the messaging all together. All the pieces fell into the right spot because it really, really matters right now. And on the other hand, these lawyers for the president were rambling. And it was scary to me to hear that rambling because they were acting as if it was already a foregone conclusion. And that's the most dispiriting part of all of this, is that a good portion of the Senate is not going to act as an impartial juror. They're not going to review the evidence in a manner that an ordinary citizen, a member of any jury, would have an obligation to do so. That, to me, is shameful. It's an abdication of their oath of office. And I think, frankly, should not be allowed in one way or another. I don't think jury nullification by the Senate should be something that we can countenance as a nation during an impeachment.
Well, it's a unique jury setup that they have where all 100 senators are part of the jury, and many of them are not unbiased at all. And, you know, what you say definitely rings true as far as Trump's legal team and the way they're trivializing what has been presented. It's worse than that. If you look on Twitter, you'll see things, you'll see senators, you'll see representatives, you'll see Trump's own son mocking and ridiculing the people who were the victims here, who were being hunted like animals and threatened with execution. And AOC was being mocked by Don Jr. at one point, saying that she was upset because a cop frowned at her, which was not at all what this was about. And all kinds of other trivializations of very real threats. And if you did not believe the threats were real, then you need to see the films that were played before the Senate today and yesterday and tell me that it doesn't scare the crap out of you to just think of those people rampaging through the halls of Congress, and God help the people that got in their way. And, yeah, the Democrats really got it together, But credit where credit is due, the Proud Boys, the white supremacists, the Nazis, they gave them a lot of good material. And they worked with that, and they presented that to the American people, and I think a lot of minds will be swayed by that. In the Senate, yeah, probably a lot of senators are stubbornly going to hold on. I can't imagine why, other than total fear of Trump, total fear of him coming down on them if they say the slightest thing critical of him. That is something, if you find yourself in fear of anybody to that degree, you have to let go of that somehow. I don't care if you're a senator or a 10-year-old, you cannot live in fear. And if you can look at what was presented over the past couple of days and not see that something incredibly horrible happened and was perpetrated by the president, and there's no disputing this because you see him speaking, you see the people in the crowd repeating his words, and you see the people in the crowd acting upon those very words. There can be no doubt. I mean, unless there is some smoking gun that has not been presented by anybody, there can be no doubt that there is a cause and effect here. So for senators to not take that into account when they cast their vote, that would be shameful. And I fully expect a shameful outcome. What I do think is a mistake for Democrats to keep saying. I don't know if they're the ones saying this or if commentators on television are the ones saying this. But to make it as if this is the reason for doing this is to keep them from running again in 2024. That cannot be the reason, because that basically elevates him to the status of somebody who is someone unbeatable, someone to be scared of. No, the reason to put him on trial is for accountability of a very serious crime against the entire nation. And he needs to be held to account. And he's never been held to account, and it's time that stopped. Go ahead, Alex.
I think that, you know, this goes farther back in time as well than the moments that were proximate to the insurrection itself. And this is part of, I think, the issue that we're seeing, especially with the social media platforms, and the question as to whether or not they have any measure of culpability in what happened on January 6th as well, in that what Trump was doing since the elections, literally since the night of the election, and in fact before it, was calling into question the legitimacy of the results, refusing to acknowledge that a peaceful transfer of power is what the country needed, refusing to acknowledge the results as they were coming in, and then claiming that the only way that he could have lost, and the Republicans could have lost the White House, was through abject fraud. And, you know, it's incredible that I even have to say this, but, you know, words matter, right? And words that come from the office of the President of the United States have held, since the beginning of this nation, a great amount of credence and credibility associated with them, and it has all gone out the window over the last 4 years. The lies and the fraud that have come from the President of the United States in perpetuating this myth that the election was stolen started well before January 6th, well before he told people to march down Pennsylvania Avenue. This was a slow degradation, once again, of the truth, an assault on the truth that was allowed to propagate and was allowed to perpetuate itself through social media channels until the last moment, when it was too late, when people were dead, when there was violence and insurrection on the streets. That's the sad state of affairs for this country.
I think there is still some opportunity for the senators that are in this trial to hear things that they didn't really understand and see it reframed in this trial setting. There's all kinds of evidence that was not something that punditry and, you know, cable TV was going over in the days or hours and minutes after this thing had started on the 6th. So I really feel like some of the things they're bringing forth, as well as what was already known, is really rounding out the whole picture, so that there really is an opportunity. Maybe that's misplaced, and I'm sure there's plenty of Republicans who will not impress insofar as their integrity goes with this. But I maintain that, you know, anyone, people are still persuadable, and they can change.
Yes.
And as things come out in this trial, we're not sitting there; we're watching it. They have to sit there, and they can't say anything under pain of imprisonment.
I'm fascinated by that. So if they say something, they can be imprisoned.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. That's interesting.
It's like worse than elementary school. I don't know. I can't wait.
You can lead a deadly insurrection to the Capitol, not be imprisoned, but you can say something in a trial and be imprisoned. That's an interesting system.
It's a serious protocol, but it's really important that they sit there and have to listen and have to pay attention to this, as I said, this thing that was built out and is totally reframed after the fact. There's less emotion. There's still emotion, but I really like the cadence of seriousness and tone that's bringing forth each part of that timeline and the place of the rhetoric in how it substantiates the article itself.
Well, I mean, that's what I hope, is that they are listening and they are judging, because that is what they are supposed to be doing. And it would be a very inspirational thing to see people say, yeah, I thought this way before, and I realize now I was wrong. And some people have done that already. Some Republicans have actually said that. They're paying the price for it. And incredibly, people who spoke out against this deadly violence are the ones who are being targeted. But because that's happening, because there are angry mobs calling for their heads, that should only make you realize all the more how right you were for saying that. And I think the more people who stand up and say something similar, the weaker those crowds will be. The lower their voices will be heard. We can't yield to this kind of thing. If we do, then the country is lost, and God knows what it is will turn into. On the subject of Twitter, according to the CFO of Twitter, and I bet nobody knows who that is. Ned Segal, I'm just pronouncing it that way because I think that's how it's pronounced, said that Trump's ban is permanent. The way our policies work, when you're removed from the platform, you're removed from the platform. Whether you're a commentator, you're a CFO like me, or you're a former, why do I pick CFO? You are a former or current public official. Remember, our policies are designed to make sure that people are not inciting violence, and if anybody does that, we have to remove them from the service. And our policies don't allow people to come back. Sounds so final and serious. The statement comes amid Trump's impeachment trial in Congress, and if he is acquitted, Trump would not be barred from seeking the presidency or another federal office. Twitter took the unprecedented step of banning Trump last month after some of Trump's supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol. At the time, Twitter said it was permanently suspending Trump due to the risk of further incitement of violence. By the time of the crackdown, Twitter had already temporarily locked Trump's account over several tweets that said contributed to an elevated risk of violence. Now, Twitter's decision to ban Trump came amid a flurry of other tech company enforcement actions against his account, including Facebook's decision to prohibit Trump from posting indefinitely, and YouTube's decision to begin issuing strikes to Trump's video channel. And I don't think that's undemocratic at all. I think that is basically in response to what people want. And people don't want this crap. They've said so in elections. They've said so to the CFOs and to all kinds of other officials from these tech companies. It's something that we need to really be responsible for. Yeah, it's entertaining to have all of this craziness in front of us, but I think we all see now how detrimental it ultimately can be. Go ahead, Alex.
And it's also a question of business and the bottom line for these types of platforms as well, because if they turn a blind eye to this kind of violence, this kind of fomenting of insurrection, sedition, whatever you want to call it, that results in death and bodily injury, you can damn well be sure that they're going to be named in a slew of lawsuits for failing to do something, for knowing that there were reasonably foreseeable consequences of allowing somebody to persist in inciting violence on their platform. That's a very, very reasonable lawsuit that these platforms can expect. And I do think, it was the right thing for them to do, to pull these accounts. I think we can all agree that once Twitter started flagging as misinformation and false some of the facts that Trump was spewing on his own Twitter page shortly after election night, that was when this all started to really snowball. And I think they took some baby steps, and I think they're going to learn a lot from those baby steps that they took. Hopefully they won't be taking baby steps again in the future, but hopefully this won't ever happen again. I really hope that this was a one-off situation that we're seeing as a country. And maybe, because it happened here, it won't be allowed to happen elsewhere where there is a lot of civil unrest, like Myanmar or Turkey. But Emmanuel, you brought up an interesting issue that if the ban is permanent, and I wonder about this now, if the ban is permanent and Trump does run for re-election and wins, let's say, in the doomsday scenario in 4 years, would Twitter give him the POTUS account?
Well, I think the POTUS account would be given to the White House staff, and if it got usurped by a maniac, they'd shut that down too, and rightfully so. You said that they did the responsible thing, and I agree, they did the responsible thing, but they did it 4 years too late. You know, they should have been doing this when he was calling Mexicans rapists and all the other horrors that he was spewing years earlier. And instead, they waited until virtually the day he was out of office. And you see the result. There was something like a 75% drop in all these lies and falsehoods being posted on Twitter as soon as he disappeared. So these things do matter.
I think one aspect where we will see this again is in other forms. And I think we need to take a long, hard look at the social media platforms and the grand experiment that it's been when new technologies come back. So in distinction from where we might see this kind of thing repeated with this particular type of technology, I think this, just in the trial itself, these tweets are now evidence, like exhibit A, B, C, you know, and so on. So, yeah, he's not there, but this is also becoming his Achilles. At least it's showing him for who he was, if it doesn't actually have a consequence this time. And I think we need to really, when all that VC money is being thrown around for the next technology that's going to save humanity and that we're dumping cash into and telling everyone they need to move their lives to and sign away all their rights, like, we need to think back to this little experiment and where it went afoul and not just pat the platforms on the head. I know I say that a lot, but I just had to get that in here in this discussion once again.
Go ahead, Rob.
It also really strikes me how, the right now is claiming censorship when Twitter, blocks Trump's account, or when Facebook blocks Trump's account. The rest of the time they're the party of letting private industry and the free market do what it wants, but until it does what they don't want. But the other side of this is really questioning not only our dependence on social media and the place it has in our media environment, but also the responsibility of someone who puts up a social media site. How much of what their users do is a site responsible for? That's something that's cursed every type of website since the public web started being a thing. And as a publisher, there's all sorts of implications there.
Yeah, we've learned all this in IRC back in the 90s. You know, when somebody comes into your channel and they're all disruptive and causing chaos, you kick them out. If they keep coming back in, you ban them. You know, there are steps you take. And, yeah, they're going to say, oh, you're censoring me. You're keeping me from saying what I want to say. No, you can say what you want to say. Just don't say it here, because this is something that we're in charge of, and you're quite frankly screwing it up.
I agree, Rob, wholly, and this is what I mean also, and to bring this back around to hacking and communications and telephony, the carriers too, because they're the ones that bundle a lot of this software on devices. They want all that data traffic. I mean, again, beating something that I've talked about over and over again, I'll keep saying it, but this is mobile carriers wanting to sell you plans that have some kind of service that you're going to be addicted to keep using all of that data and do something with this needless technology that just keeps going and going and going. We really, really, really need to look at this.
Alex, I think you had one more point, then we're going to move on to some other topics.
Sure. One of the things that I mentioned this at Hope, too, that I can foresee happening with these social media platforms, because we saw the precursors of it around the time that HOPE was happening this past summer, is that Congress started asking them questions, started asking the platforms, the big platforms like Facebook and Twitter, what are you doing to combat misinformation ahead of the 2020 election? In an election year, obviously, it's really, really important, given especially what happened in 2016. They want to make sure that the platforms are doing something. I think instead of focusing on Section 230, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which I think Rob was alluding to, which gives the platforms any kind of interactive computer service immunity for the content that goes through their networks. They're not responsible for the content and the speech that goes through their networks. Instead of modifying that, which is a law, a provision of law that allowed the Internet really to grow and to flourish, what Congress could be doing is expecting more now of the social media platforms. Just like cybersecurity is a growing compliance issue, I foresee reasonable measures being required to be put in place by these social media platforms to make sure that misinformation does not propagate to the extent that we've seen it propagate over this last year.
All right. Well, we'll continue talking about this in the weeks and months ahead. And, of course, if you want to write to us, oth@2600.com is our email address. We certainly would like to hear from our listeners. You're listening to Off the Hook here on WBAI New York. We're on until 8 o'clock. At 8 o'clock, we are doing Off the Hook Overtime on YouTube. You go to Channel 2600. It's one word, no space. Channel 2600 on YouTube at 8 o'clock. And you'll be able to call us and talk to us. In a podcast setting. We'll give you the phone number now. Why not? 802-321-4225. I trust you unplug the phone, Kyle, so it won't ring.
And it will not.
Disturb us. Good. 802-321-HACK is the magical phone number to reach us starting at 8 o'clock. Here's an interesting story that I saw in the New York Times. Hugh Ma is a 31-year-old software engineer for Airbnb. He was stunned when he tried to make a coronavirus vaccine appointment for his mother in early January and saw that there were dozens of websites to check, each with its own sign-up protocol. The city and state appointment systems were completely distinct. He said, there has to be a better way, so he developed one. Yeah, in less than 2 weeks, he launched TurboVax, a free website that compiles availability from the three main city and state New York vaccine systems and sends the information in real time to Twitter. Not exactly sure why it's being sent to Twitter, but I'm sure if I experiment with it, I'll figure it out. It cost Mr. Ma less than $50 to build, yet it offers an easier way to spot appointments than the city and state's official systems do. It's sort of become a challenge to myself to prove what one person with time and a little motivation can do. This wasn't a priority for governments, which was unfortunate, but everyone has a role to play in the pandemic, and I'm just doing the very little that I can to make it a little bit easier. And that is the true hacker spirit, is to be able to step in and say, I can do this better. And I think this is a time where we really, really need that. Jeremy Novich, 35 years old, a clinical psychologist in the Upper West Side, started reaching out to seniors after realizing that his own older relatives could not have made appointments on their own. He said the system is set up to be a technology race between 25-year-olds and 85-year-olds. That's not a race, that's elder neglect. Along with two friends, on January 12th, he launched the Vaccine Appointment Assistance Team, a person-to-person effort that began by helping older people from local synagogues and expanded to help those who sign up via a phone hotline or web form. Because of high demand, the service, which now has 20 volunteer caseworkers, has stopped taking new cases for now, and the founders are thinking about partnering with a nonprofit to increase capacity. The most ambitious online volunteer assistance effort in the city is NYC Vaccine List, a website that compiles appointments for more than 50 vaccination sites, city, state, and private. About 20 volunteers write code, reach out to community organizations, and call inoculation centers directly to post the center's availabilities. Dan Benami, a software developer for Datadog and one of NYC Vaccine List founders, said that when he was searching last month for dates for his grandparents, he was struck at how labor-intensive the appointment system was. I'm an engineer and an optimizer, so I was looking at this and saying it feels like we could maybe look at pulling this data together and aggregating it so that it's faster and easier to find vaccines. He reached out to a couple of friends and got to work. The site went live 5 days later on January 16th. Now, inspired by VaccinateCA, a volunteer-run vaccine finder site in California, NYC vaccine list not only lists available city and state appointments, but also allows users to click through more directly to some available appointment times, saving precious minutes in which a slot could go to someone else. These are such great developments and a true testament to the power of the individual, something we were talking about earlier. And I just hope that hackers and people in the computer industry throughout the globe are brainstorming and trying to figure out ways to make this bureaucratic system work better to everyone's benefit. Because I took a look at some of those sites myself, and boy, they are discouraging. And with everybody pretty much looking for a vaccine either now or in the very near future, we need those sites to work a whole lot better. Rob.
Yeah, this is a great example of the hacker spirit and how it can be used for the public good. Just want to give a shout out. It's nycvaccinelist.com is that site you were just talking about. And the Twitter account is TurboVax. And what's really interesting about it being on Twitter is it's kicking this data out in real time. So if you go to TurboVax, T-U-R-B-O-V-A-X on Twitter right now, you can see 6 minutes ago there was a post about 4 appointments that opened up in Staten Island and, you know, 3 appointments before that. And so like bit by bit as this data is coming out, you can get it when you need it, you know, updated now. And this stuff is great.
I actually found out I qualify to get a vaccine, and the reason I qualify is because I got locked up by the NYPD in 2004 for the Republican convention when it was in New York City, and they stuck me in Pier 57, which was this horrible, dusty, chemical-filled place, and I developed asthma after that. And now because I have asthma, I can qualify. I have a comorbidity. I never was thought I'd be happy to say that. And starting next week, I can actually apply to get a vaccine. Does that make me first in this little group?
Yeah, I mean, I had to be born with asthma. You got yours given to you.
But wait, you qualify then, too. If you have asthma, you qualify as well. So that's good news, actually. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah. Well, one interesting point about this and the TurboVax thing in particular, I think is so important. Great, great show of the hacker spirit. I totally agree. And that in monitoring what we've been seeing in the global DNS with regard to the vaccine, there are so many disparate vaccine sites that do pop up that allow scheduling. And I think I've mentioned this before, but some of them are also very vulnerable in that they rely on these third party sites like Eventbrite to do the scheduling for the vaccine. It'd be pretty easy to script a bot to take up all of those slots. Let's say if you were some adamant anti-vaxxer and you didn't want people to get the vaccine because you were affected mentally by misinformation that was allowed to have been propagated, God knows who knows, you know, from God knows where. So I see this as incredibly important to have this centralized place where hopefully it's a little bit more secure and it's a little bit more uniform. What's also interesting about this from a DNS perspective is this was developed a couple of weeks ago, but if you look up TurboVax.com, that's a domain that's existed since 2016. Would you be able to guess why, Emmanuel?
What is the actual name of it again?
TurboVax.
And how do you spell Vax?
V-A-X.
Is it related to the computer system, Vax?
No.
Oh.
Well, that's a good question.
That would have been my guess. That would have been my guess.
Think about TurboVax. Sounds like something else.
TurboFax.
TurboTax.
Oh, that was my next guess afterwards. All right, TurboTax.
Was it now? Yeah. So TurboVax.com is not the actual domain name if you want to get to TurboVax. TurboVax.com will take you actually to TurboTax. TurboVax.info is the actual domain name to which you must navigate if you want to get to the scheduling system.
Okay, TurboTax people, just as a public service, can you put something on your website for those people who type TurboVax.com and get to you? Because clearly they're not looking to file taxes. They're looking to save their lives.
Exactly. It's a simple redirect. It's a simple redirect, and they've held this domain for the last close to 5 years. It was registered in 19 April 2016, so coming up to 5 years. And they have it essentially as a permutation of TurboTax, right? You know, maybe somebody squatted on it and they reclaimed it, whatever. But I think it's time to redirect that to TurboVax.info.
I'm going to the site right now to verify where it is it actually goes. TurboVax.com, you say?
This is exactly TurboVax. The wrong season to be making these kinds of demands of TurboTax.
Yeah, it goes right to TurboTax.intuit.com. And yeah, I feel that either a redirect or a notice on their site to direct people to who are looking for the vaccine, who type that in error or because it makes sense to type that in. Good find there, Alex. All right, we've been getting lots of mail. Lately, we've just been getting more mail than ever, and that's great. We love to get listener mail. Here's one from Alan. I just tuned into your show, heard you discussing network solutions. 4 years ago, I tried to hire them as my registered agent for my small LLC business. They pulled some shady move where they changed the agreement, and I wanted to cancel with them, and they made it so impossible that I had to call my credit card and ask them to cancel them as a vendor, which they did. To this day, Network Solutions sends me emails straight to my spam box about unpaid invoices. I'm sorry, but also relieved to hear I'm not the only person. So thanks. Well, thank you, Alan, for making me feel a little bit better. But they did rip me off as well by charging me for something I never signed up for and doing it every single year, complaining my credit card number got changed and then somehow finding out my new credit card number, which really that was very upsetting to me that they actually figured out to how to do that somehow. And actually, there's another letter that addresses that from Hack5190. I had to laugh as you were describing that someone had guessed your new credit card information. Years ago, I had the same experience, and that's when I learned about card updater services, when a vendor updated my on-file card information without my help for a service I wanted to end. There's a very good chance you agreed to allow this in the terms and conditions that none of us, except for Alex, ever read. It does say that, Alex. American Express, MasterCard, Visa, and Discover all offer such services. Thanks for the laugh, and keep up the good fight. Well, I will keep up the good fight, but I wasn't intending to give you a laugh. That's very serious, so I don't know what to do. I mean, they're going to continue billing me for this. I can't reach them on the phone. Maybe I'll visit. That's what I'll do. I'll go down and figure out where they are.
They'll appreciate that.
Yeah, I'm sure they will.
Yeah.
What else we have here? OTH at 2600.com is our... email address. Here's a mail from a long-time listener, first-time emailer named Brandon. He's from Seattle. The solution to your live YouTube show user notification problem. Yeah, we're not good at YouTube, so we were trying to figure out how to let more people know about the podcast edition, the overtime that starts at 8 o'clock, rather than have people find out at 8 o'clock what the URL is. We found the URL, and we tweeted it out on the 2600 account. But we figure there's got to be better ways. This person says you start streaming in advance, say 10 to 20 minutes, and in place of the actual show, you stream a countdown. Then you share the countdown stream and let people queue up and await you all coming online. Then when the time is up, you just switch the broadcast over to you. I use OBS. I think that's what we use as well, where this can be done by adding a countdown scene and a stream scene. Brandon, it's a good idea. The only problem is that the machine that we use for the streaming is also used for the broadcast. And since we end at 55 after the hour and the other podcast begins at 8 o'clock, it's not much time for us to do the countdown. But it's a good idea, and we'll try to – maybe we'll get another computer or something. We could do
that. Like if you were playing a clip, that would go out over the countdown because it also needs to go to a board or something.
Uh-huh. It's not easy. It sounds easy.
It's technically possible. It's just, you know, be mindful that, you know, it takes some configuration and resources, and sometimes those are not available.
Okay, I want to talk about this water supply situation because this is in the news. Everyone's discussing this right now. From the New York Times, hackers remotely accessed the water treatment plant of a small Florida city last week and briefly changed the levels of lye in the drinking water. In the kind of critical infrastructure intrusion that cybersecurity experts have long warned about. I guess we sort of count in that group of people. The attack in Oldsmar, a city of 15,000 people in the Tampa Bay area, was caught before it could inflict harm. Sheriff Bob Galtieri of Pinellas County said at a news conference Monday that the level of sodium hydroxide, the main ingredient in drain cleaner, was changed from 100 parts per million to 11,100 parts per million. It's like somebody leaned on the one key a little bit. Dangerous levels that could have badly sickened residents if it had reached their homes. This is dangerous stuff, he said. It's a bad act. It's a bad actor. It's not just a little chlorine or a little fluoride. You're basically talking about lye. The authorities said the plot unfolded last Friday morning when an employee noticed that someone was controlling his computer. He initially dismissed it because the city has software that allows supervisors to access computers remotely, but about 5.5 hours later, the employee saw that different programs were opening and that the level of lie was changed. Okay, so my initial take on this, and tell me if I'm crazy, and you know, I've said this before, I have been told that I am crazy and unrealistic for even thinking this, but why in God's name does a plant like this need to be accessed remotely in the first place? Aren't there people there, and apparently there were people on site who should be the only ones that are able to access the network that changes chemicals in water? Can someone just tell me why that's a dream or something that's impossible, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, the articles about this specify that they had TeamViewer set up, and it was a normal thing for this person to have their supervisor go into their computer for supervisory reasons. But, yes, that could be easily put together on a company intranet and not accessible from the internet. When the only calls can come from inside the house, as it were, you're a lot safer with something that could actually cause damage. By all accounts, this didn't actually change anything in the water supply. It was somebody who moved a slider up, and it was immediately put back down.
And that's another thing. Why can you move the slider up to poison an entire population? That should be disallowed right there. There's no logical reason to ever want to do that.
Yeah, you're trying to turn down the volume on your computer, and all of a sudden everyone dies. But it is crazy that this stuff would be internet-facing at all.
Mm-hmm. Alex?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is expediency, and we can certainly comment after the fact and say there are plenty of better ways to do this. They could have used a secure VPN. They shouldn't have access. But especially in today's world, where we see these types of municipalities having a great amount of responsibility with no regulatory oversight, the lack of funding, and the need for their employees to be able to do their job and administer the water supply in the midst of a global health crisis.
Let me stop you right there, though. In the midst of, because I keep hearing this a lot, too, because of coronavirus, we're blaming everything on coronavirus, so people can't go to a water treatment plant where I don't think that thousands of people work. I think it's a fairly small crew of people. I'm not really sure. But for something like that, you're saying that people are being encouraged to stay away? It seems like that's a bad idea.
Well, I'm not saying it's entirely the cause of this, but it's certainly part of the problem, in that you have these quickly stood up IT systems, remote access systems, that are put in place without afterthought to the security configurations that may have been overlooked. Right? There are certainly better ways to do this, but these things are what's known as HMIs, or these human machine interfaces, where they are pretty self-evident from the name. It's an interface that allows a human to control a complex machine. And we live in the 21st century. We don't necessarily have to be there in order to do it. I totally agree there should be greater security precautions in place. And for something like TeamViewer to be used here, which is just, essentially remote desktop software, I can go and, move the mouse around on your screen by using TeamViewer. It's something that's used essentially for tech support. It shouldn't be used to administer a water supply, but from some of the other stories I've been reading on this, too, is that TeamViewer can actually be considered an improvement to some of these public-facing HMI interfaces that are just out there on the web. At least TeamViewer needs to be discovered by way of an IP address or something like that. So, I think we shouldn't be too quick to criticize here. I also understand that there were other physical safeguards in place that would have prevented this from actually taking place. And I think that's important. But what's really worrying to me is that there are going to be more sophisticated adversaries that are able to do this. And what I think that this, may play into, if you think about the policies that we had back in the Cold War of mutually assured destruction, and these types of mutually assured destruction was a deterrent for nuclear war. And what we have now is more of a race to find critical vulnerabilities and proof of concept of those critical vulnerabilities between nations. Because we know that digital actions can have a kinetic effect. And if the United States is very, very good at finding critical vulnerabilities in other nations' infrastructures, then other nations are going to be trying to find those very same vulnerabilities in our infrastructures. And this is the digital arms race that we're in right now. And so what's scary to me is that this looks like it could have been some angry employee who did this. We also know that there was a similar situation in Israel, you know, and it may or may not have been connected, but Israel and the United States are collaborating and sharing information about this. But what this could also be is proof of concept of a foreign adversary that they have access to our infrastructure systems.
Yeah, I think that's entirely likely. And what the actual vulnerability may have been a completely other type of communication, meaning someone was monitoring or something that wasn't taken that seriously, allowed someone who was not authorized to understand that TeamViewer was being used. Could have been sort of a email that was not handled right, but a part of their regular operational security, not thinking that a public email or some kind of public communications or otherwise insecure communications would lead to someone maybe getting a copy of that or a key or some insight into how to get to another layer of, okay, now I'm using the remote viewing software to understand stuff that is completely behind the scenes. I think an operational bit of infrastructure that has sort of this free software or this commercial stuff added on ad hoc in sort of a security through obscurity type of way. And I really think Rob's point and Alex hit it. It is really hard to have things offline when you want other things to tell you what kind of, you know, levels you have of chemicals, and you want to have that tied into procurement so that, you know, orders for things are done, and also maintenance of this stuff. You know, you're maintaining a water system. The computers and equipment may have been introduced a long time ago, and the budget is there to, like, buy valves and parts and pipes and things. You're not exactly running your cable and upgrading this stuff. You're sort of adding on to it layer by layer, thinking it won't really be of any importance, and you end up with stuff that's woefully out of date. So I think it's a combination of all of these things, and of course, perhaps increasing amounts of people listening and trying to find these kinds of vulnerabilities in public infrastructure.
I know it's convenient to be able to do these things remotely, but you know, if you need to read things, fine, you can read things. But if you need to change something, you call somebody at the plant and have them do it. They're on site, you know. Sure, it's easier for you to be able to do everything from your iPhone, but it's not smart. It's not safe. That's my concern.
Yeah. And I mean, I remember I worked in production, and there was a machine there that people would use for browsing and stuff, and it's also running all of the controls and systems for a production system. That was a huge deal, and people who were doing that got in a lot of trouble for it. But it wasn't found out for a long time, so there's probably a lot of other people who can relate with this story. I have lots of stories about that.
Okay, but we're out of time. We can continue this on Overtime, which is starting up at 8 o'clock. If you go to YouTube.com and go to Channel 2600, one word, you'll find us there, and we'll be able to take your phone calls, 802-321-4225. Meanwhile, write to us off the hook, OTH at 2600.com. We will see you back here next week. Good night.
Thank you for listening to Off the Hook.
Complicated times. Sometimes it seems like important voices get left out, and sometimes it's hard to know who to trust. But one thing's for sure. For more than 60 years, WBAI has been your go-to for independent, non-commercial, free speech programming. Join the WBAI family as a BAI buddy in the name of your favorite show today and support radio you can trust.